I am absolutely thrilled to be speaking with director Eli Corus and director and editor Joshua Schaefer talking about their first feature documentary, American Skyjacker. Based on their own podcast series, which was a 6-hour, 10-episode project called American Hijacker, Final Flight of Martin McNally, this is the story of Martin McNally, convicted skyjacker. Now, I remember skyjackings from elementary school and junior high school. That was big news back in those days. Between just 1967 and 1972, over 300 commercial airplanes were hijacked worldwide. Over 130 of those were in the U.S. alone. Of course, the most famous skyjacker was D.B. Cooper, who hijacked a plane in late 1971, demanding $200,000, and after he got the money, jumped out of the plane mid-flight, never to be heard from again. There have been many narratives and documentaries and articles written about D.B. Cooper, but nobody really knows to this day what happened. Everything is an assumption. But then we get Martin McNally. Martin McNally, who grew up idolizing D.B. Cooper. And he hijacked an American Airlines flight out of St. Louis just 6 months after D.B. Cooper disappeared. But he got $500,000. However, his has a beginning, a middle, and an end. He lost his $500,000 as he jumped out of the plane. It was later discovered not too long after he disappeared, discovered in a soybean field. A rural farmer found it. But McNally, he eventually was caught. He was captured. However, his story doesn't end with his capture. His story continues as he went to prison, and in prison met another, a fellow criminal, and teams up with him, befriends him. And together, they're plotting how to get out of prison, while each one is regaling tales of their own hijacking adventures, and then a woman gets involved, which adds another wrinkle. It's like Martin McNally really takes you down the rabbit hole, and that's exactly what Eli and Joshua do with American Skyjacker. This is so much fun watching this. It's done with recreations, with archival footage. How much more authentic can you get than having Walter Cronkite, the actual newscast of Walter Cronkite reporting on McNally's skyjacking? It's just, they go soup to nuts, cover it all. I so love this documentary. It belies this being a first-time feature for Eli and Joshua. So I am beyond tickled to be able to talk with them right now about Martin McNally, etc., etc., etc. Hi, Eli. Hi, Joshua. I love this movie, documentary. This is absolutely fantastic. But
thanks so much.
It's not a Talking Heads documentary, which one might expect. You've got plenty of Talking Heads, but you're not doing this question-answer. And it's all being led by our perpetrator himself, by Mac McNally, which is very unique. But then you make it very cinematic, thanks to your recreations and the stellar editing that puts this package together. Guys, just job so well done. on bringing this story to life. And it's not just Mac's story. We go down the rabbit hole as to, you know, the butterfly effect, where one thing then affects something else, affects something else, affects something else. And we really get to see it play out. Just because this guy, as a youth, thought D.B. Cooper was cool. For lack of a better description. So I'm curious. I know that there was an article, Danny Wisentowski's article, I believe started all of this for the two of you. At what point did, once you read Danny's article, or if you were familiar with these skyjackings of years gone by, what sparked you to then think, a podcast, a documentary, a podcast? How do we put the chicken before the egg, the horse before the cart, or vice versa?
So we initially read that article, as you said, and I think it was Josh who was like, this is incredible, this is absolutely something. And I think it was probably the moment where David Hanley crashes his plane into, or sorry, his car into the plane, rather. And it was just so completely out of the box that, you know, we had to do something with it. Josh and I had been screenwriting together, had been selling screenplays for about 6 years. We sold a script a year from about 2010 to about 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And we read Danny's article in 2017, and we're, you know, looking for articles to adapt into scripts. And, you know, you had to acquire your own IP. That was the word on the street at the time. Everybody has to have their own IP. IP adaptation is the way to go. That's how you sell things, right? And so we saw Danny's article. We're like, let's go get it. We talked to Danny. We'd adapted an LA Magazine article and successfully sold that. So we felt like we knew what we were doing. And Danny, you know, gave us the rights, and we start, you know, the 3,000-mile climb to try to adapt the script into something. And Danny's telling us, he's like, listen, Martin McNally's still alive, and he's willing to talk to you. Would you guys, you know, want to get on the phone with him and do an interview? And I was thinking about it, and I was like, this guy's living history, you know, and maybe we could just put him on camera. Let's put a crew together and just get him on tape, just for posterity's sake.
Sure.
And so by this point, it's 2019, spring of 2019, and we hustled a crew together and went out to St. Louis and shot with him for 4 days. And that is the main interview you see in the film. Now, we shot a lot of other ones over the next few years, obviously, too, but that was the main interview. And so we're like, all right, well, now we have this interview. It's sort of where we can plant our flag and adapt everything off, and it makes it completely unique beyond the articles, or helps the quote-unquote package for, you know, business speak in Hollywood. And then we suddenly realized, though, we're now selling a documentary, too. So we started going out to try to sell a documentary. We cut a great sizzle reel together and walked into Imperative Entertainment in October of 2019. And they were like, look, we're setting up a podcast division. This is kind of the philosophy. You make a podcast. You build an audience. You get to tell the whole story. And then we go out and we make, you know, the documentary, the television series, the film off of that. And they're like, and, you know, we'll cut you a check and you guys just get to do it, which was, you know, that was the main thing. It was like music careers. We get to have money and we get to go out and make our own thing with very little oversight. And that started us down the road of making a podcast, which, you know, Josh, I had listened to podcasts. I think Serial was popular then. That was pretty much the only podcast anybody knew at that point. But it happened to be the heyday for podcasts. And then, you know, 4 months later, the entire world shut down. And the only thing you could produce or listen to, for the most part, was podcast. So it was kind of perfect.
Oh my God. I like the part of they cut you a check. Not often you walk in an office and you're talking and they say, okay, and they cut you a check.
It wasn't that clear, but it was more or less like that.
Yes. But I'm sure there wasn't a lot of begging and pleading and down on your knees offering up your firstborn child in exchange for funding. Which, as you both know, in this business, that's generally what's involved. But, oh my God, that is a very wonderfully auspicious way to kick off your project. Now, you've got your 6-hour podcast, 10 episodes, which is fantastic. But then you've got to think about turning this into a documentary. Now you need visuals. And this, you really excel. And I don't know if you had a full-fledged research team or if you did this yourselves, but your reenactments and the authenticity of what you bring, number one, the photographs, the caddy burning up underneath the plane, the wing of the plane, is fantastic. And I know that that's an authentic photograph. You have quite a few authentic photographs. Of course, who better to be reporting on skyjackings than Walter Cronkite?
That's right.
You automatically infuse authenticity, believability, and gravitas by using by pulling Cronkite's footage of reporting on these stories. But then you actually get a 727 plane. You're recreating skydiving. Guys, and then all of the newsreel footage that populates and punctuates what some of your interviewers are saying, and then your actual hiring of actors to recreate the players. How did you even start approaching the visual aspect of crafting this? Because this is well crafted.
So I'll start by talking about the archives. And then I'll pass it off to Eli to talk about the recrees. But for the archival stuff, we had a great archival producer, Chris, who helped us find all those wonderful clips. But if ever there was a story that was stranger than fiction, it was this one, in our opinion. And so what the archive really does, in my opinion, is anytime it gets outlandish and it gets into the, you know, too hard to believe territory, you have those archival clips of Walter Cronkite, of other anchors telling you, no, this actually happened, and reporting on it. And so I think that without those clips, we would not have a documentary. People would be like, there's no way this actually happened. Yeah. We can't just trust it from one guy's mouth. But then to find those clips that really pin it to reality, I think that that's what makes our film, you know, so special.
Yeah. No one is going to dispute Walter Cronkite.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
It really just grounds in reality. I mean, I think the best example in the film is with, you know, Hanley crashing his Cadillac in the plane again, which is definitely the most out of left field, you know, subplot, if you want to call it that, or event that happens in the film. But then you can cut from him smashing into the plane to the actual burned up photo, which just grounds it completely in reality and kind of like, as a viewer, if you don't know this story, kind of just like, holy shit, this is actually real. This hasn't gone off the rails. You know, this thing has not jumped the shark yet. As far as to answer your question about the plane, you know, and the plans for the documentary, I think subconsciously we'd always plan for the documentary, or maybe it was sort of like a safety net, I suppose. Mm-hmm. We kept shooting our interviews. So almost all of the interviews, I'd say, or rather, let's put it this way, 80% of the interviews you see in the film were shot when we produced the documentary. We produced the podcast. Mm-hmm. We produced the podcast. So we just continued shooting our interviews multicam. And then supplemented a few more for the documentary itself. Now, we, you know, as we start getting into the documentary production, we realize, all right, we're going to have recrees because you can't tell the story any other way. There was some brief exploration of doing it in a really cool animated way, and then we saw the price tag on that. We're like, well, that's not going to happen. And then we're also left with the problem of like, well, you know, we need a plane. We need to crash a car into a plane. We need a prison. We need a helicopter. We need to be able to jump out of the back of a plane. And so it became really just sort of bootstrap indie filmmaking. And it was, God, it was a lot of work. It was so much fun. It was just, you know, calling around. And we did it also, I'd just like to say, entirely, all the recrees were done entirely in Southern California. So you can produce films on an indie budget in Southern California. It just takes a lot of work on the production end. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, calling around Boneyard, Plane Yard, calling Ontario International Airport, which we almost used but couldn't. Ironically, plane that had a back staircase. It was not technically a 727, but it was close. And we were able to use that plane with the back staircase for the skydiving bit. And they also conveniently had a whole skydiving team who were professional skydivers. And, you know, the pilot who flew the plane where our skydiving team jumped out of was worked on Point Break because they shot some of the skydiving at Point Break there. So they had kind of this storied history of skydiving stunts, which was pretty fun. So that became our, that was actually our first day. Our first day was the skydiving.
Oh my God.
Which was, I know it was, I was like, I don't know if I planned this that well. But it pulled it off and it was very fun. I remember like after we wrapped that first day, just sort of like sitting there and feeling like the rest of it was a little downhill, you know, because we'd gotten over the most challenging bit.
Oh,
and just to give you a little peek behind the curtain of like what some of the conversations we were having were at the time, like the David Hanley sequence, you know, at some point there was news footage of Max hijacking, of the Cadillac crashing into the plane, but because our story spans the time where news was converting from film to video, that particular part of it, the early stuff, was shot on film. And a lot of that film,
it's gone.
You know, degrades over time or was destroyed or was left in a shed in you know, behind the studio. And you know, it's just, it doesn't exist anymore. And so it really came down to, you know, we started this project being like, they have to have footage of that somewhere. And once we couldn't find it, we were like, okay, new challenge. How do we shoot a Cadillac crashing into a plane? And you just you know, figure it out, and what you can't get on the day, you end up doing in the edit.
And I have to say, the edit of that sequence is really well done. And it's, I mean, it is fraught with so much tension. And you're waiting, number one, you're waiting to see the caddy crash into the plane. And even though we don't get to see it actually crash, you cut to that photograph. So we get that sensation, call it satisfaction in seeing a train wreck, like we're driving on the freeway and we see rollovers. So you give us that satisfaction. We are rewarded. But the way that is shot in total darkness, but for like a dash light on the dashboard inside the car, and then seeing just two headlight beams coming out of the distance, that really is one of the tensest moments in the film. It's fantastic.
Thank you. I'm glad we pulled it off.
I think it is absolutely terrific. Now, besides that, you have some really incredible recreations here. I have to give a shout out to your hair and makeup and costumers. The wigs, the makeup, the costumes, the stewardess costumes for the guys. Guys have pretty much looked the same in their attire for decades. So that's not too hard. But the women and those costumes, it really put us into the correct era, the correct time, and add so much authenticity, even though it's recreations. How difficult was that? How much archival stuff did you and your artisans go through to recreate the look that was necessary for these players?
I mean, our keys were key.
Yeah.
To this. They were, I mean, we really, like, Nicole, who was our lead costumer, she just killed it. She went above and beyond. I mean, it got to the point where I was like, Nicole, I trust you. Like, you don't have to run every single thing. Because she was showing me, like, layouts of things all the time. It was just, and I have to say the same thing about our production designer, Prerna. You know, like, there's a very brief scene where Max Recree characters are all gathering in like a underground. It's like a garage, basically.
It's like a basement. Or a garage.
Garage, right? Yeah, it's like a basement or a garage. That room was literally just a room on a back lot, and I was like, "This is what we're going to use for it." And she just kind of looked at me like, "You're not paying me enough for this." And then she transformed it in a day, and it's my favorite set in the whole film. We didn't spend much time in it, but it's incredible what she was able to do. So it was like. And you know, this was indie too, and these are recrees too. And so I had, you know, top-notch key people
time to work on this, and most of it was because I think they believed in the story of the project at the end of the day, and they loved the story. You know, we actually had Mac come to set for 2 or 3 days, Josh. I can't remember exactly how many days. It's all a blur.
I think it was 2 days, but yeah.
It was 2 days. He came down to set where we were shooting all the interior fuselage scenes, a lot of the backlot scenes. And it was a wonderful experience. I think also for them too, because they, the crew, really recognized this sort of living piece of history walking around and talking to them, and them recreating his life too. And it was a very unique biographical story to tell, because mm-hmm. you're telling the story of a criminal who's somewhat nihilistic, at least when he was doing it. And yet he is there in person reviewing their work. And so they were very, very pleased when he was like, this is exactly the way it happened. It looked exactly like this, whether he was just saying that or not, you know, but they were overjoyed by that.
And I have to compliment you. There's not a whole lot that you can do when you're shooting inside a plane. You have a narrow aisle. You have lots of seats. You have people in those seats. You have people stepping over people. And you have a nut putting on a wig and sunglasses and coming out of the bathroom and slipping notes to a stewardess saying, nobody's going to get hurt. I want $500,000. I want parachutes. I want this. I want that. And it's a situation where you can't really do too much with your camera angles because of the logistics within the plane. But you play with your focal length and you have Logan come up. You do a lot of close-ups on him. His hands holding the attaché case. His eyes, even though we don't see his eyes because of the sunglasses. And then you cut to the stewardess, especially the one, the veteran one who stayed on the plane versus the younger ones who had only been on the job 3 to 4 months. You give us profiles. You give us close-ups. You have some beautiful extreme close-ups. So it varies the look inside the plane. So we feel the tension, we feel confusion, but it never looks cookie cutter, which so easily could have happened.
I can tell you that both of the planes, the interior and exterior plane, the fuselage and the plane that we shot the exterior of, we shot every single angle you could possibly shoot in there. We had a great camera team. Our DP Drew was phenomenal. He had a great team behind him. And it really allowed us to make the most out of such a tiny space. And it was a very tiny space.
Yeah. There's no way you can hide something that tiny.
There's also an aspect of this, the production design played a part in this too, where
sure.
we really kind of designed the space and outfitted the fuselage to look like one of those planes. But the goal, we had two cameras too.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about lowering the number of angles you have when you have two cameras.
Oh my
running.
God.
But it was also, I was also like, we were kind of like, guys, we're going to create this world for you. We're going to have everybody in here and you guys just play in it and you go. Because there is a lot of freedom by not really having a script, if you will. It kind of gives you more freedom where you're like, well, your script is already sort of laid out for you by what Mac
sure.
is saying and what's happening in the scene. And so we're like, we know we need to cover this, shoot this, get creative. And so there was a lot of kind of play within the set for a lot of these scenes too, which is why I think we got what we got as well.
And it definitely, I think, helped you because the actors, they're not delivering dialogue. It's all of
right.
Mac's narrative.
Right.
The voiceover that we're hearing. And that had to be, if they were delivering dialogue, I don't even want to think how you'd be pulling your hair out at that point.
A completely different process, too, you know? I mean,
yeah.
There's always a version of this that you could do as a scripted version.
Sure.
But it's a completely different process in film, and obviously a lot more focuses are on different areas of the production. You know, a little thing I forgot earlier, actually, that I wanted to mention, which is kind of an inspiration behind The Dock. There is a film that was made in 2013, 2012, 2013, called The Chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
It was made by Raw, London-based doc company. And what they did, it's about a guy who pretended to be a kid who was missing, who went missing in San Antonio, Texas. But he was French, and he looked nothing like the kid. But he convinced the family that he was kid who had gone missing. He's looking right down the barrel of the camera. He's looking right at the audience. And they always tell you, you know, don't look directly down the barrel of the camera. But that decision was such an interesting one from a cinematic perspective that we copied it for this. We took that idea and we said, all right, if Max looks down the barrel of the camera, what does that do to the audience? And it makes him speak directly to the audience, honestly. It makes it way more personal. It brings you in so much more, too. So that was kind of the first kind of rule-breaking decision we made. And then when we had to do the recrees, which we knew we had to do, then there's always a discussion of, like, all right, well, what are we doing on the recrees? If you look at every single Netflix or, you know, Amazon, HBO Max documentary, most things are rack-focused, hand, sides of faces, you know, the same shot more or less over and over, just done with like really nice lenses and lighting. And, you know, you can get away with that for a while, but it gets a little boring.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also been done to death now. And in the first shot of the movie, we show our recreators' eyes and face. And we said, we're going to throw that rule out the window immediately. And we just did it because this is about rule breaking. This whole film's about rule breaking.
Yeah.
The whole style's about rule breaking, and that's what we embraced.
And it works beautifully. Absolutely. It works beautifully. Because we feel connected to these actors. And especially as we're hearing Mac talking, we're very connected to Logan in character as Mac. So I like that. So we do get to see what is the machination going on behind the eyes.
Right.
Because we're seeing Mac. We see Logan, we go into sunglass mode, then we've got profiles and head hanging and a lot of that happening while he's trying to figure out what his next move is after things did not go as planned. So I think your rule breaking works really, really, really well in this film, and I hope more documentary filmmakers will adapt your rule breaking techniques because it adds so much to the telling of this story. Now, it's great that, you know, we've got Mac and we see what happens with his skyjacking and how things go slightly awry. I love the newspaper headlines that you incorporate in there, the archival stuff, presumed dead, not, he can't be alive, blah, 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 all of that fun stuff. And then we're seeing, the media didn't get that one right. But then we get into where then we get his buddy, his other criminal buddy in prison. And this is just when we get two of them together at Leavenworth with Garrett Trapnell. Then things takes another shift and it expands. And this is where the rabbit hole really starts to take hold. And that brings the prison into question. How do you find a prison?
We got a record number of them in this country. So
yes, we do.
There's a lot of prisons to choose from, especially in Southern California. We went and visited one that had active prisoners at it, which was a awkward experience. And they were like, "Oh, we'll just push him out of this yard," and I was just like, "I don't know about this, guys." And the security was going to be a thing, and it was just. And then I forget how it came my way, but I found out about a decommissioned prison that was up in Lancaster that nobody was at, that was just empty. They're like, it's just decommissioned for now because of budget cuts or something like that. But you can have the whole prison. And so we got the whole prison. It was like the best deal of any location, ironically. We got the whole prison and like three or four guards who were like basically just hanging out, working with us. And, that's how we shot all the prison stuff all day. And it worked perfectly because it was old. They're like, I hope you don't mind it being old. I was like, this is supposed to be the 70s. That's great.
Yeah.
So,
because you want it to be, it needs to be Leavenworth. And then, of course, we have another shift to the Supermax prison in Marion, Illinois after that. So the older, the better. I mean, hey, you could have even taken advantage and gone back to the 1700s, 1800s. Go to Philly, to East State Penitentiary, which works wonderfully in films, by the way. I know quite a few filmmakers that have shot there, and it works really well, and it's very, it adds creepy. But
prisons are relatively timeless, you know. Yes, unless you're trying to do a sci-fi film, I think.
They truly are. And the now I've got to ask you, with the prison in Lancaster that you were shooting in, did it have power, running water, things like that? Did you have to bring in any kind of generators or that equipment-wise?
Yeah, I think it was. We had to bring in Jennies. No running water. It was pretty much. It was just the shell of the prison, basically.
How rude!
I mean, we did have crew bathrooms in the one staging area that we had. That we didn't have to bring in for that.
There was no people
on the premises, basically as a security operation, but otherwise it was empty.
Yeah. Wow. But this is where it gets even trickier because we bring in Barbara Oswald. So we've got poor Mac. He's now tied in with Trapnel. Trapnel brings in Barbara. So now you have a big female presence popping up in here. And a helicopter comes into play. You know, did you get the helicopter also up in Paris, California at the skydiving school?
No, that was at Helinet, which is at the Van Nuys Airport. There was a lot of this, it was, you walk in with a story like this in your back pocket as a producer, and you say, okay, here's the story. Let me just tell you it. And so many times people are like, wait, what? Keep going. This is true. And it kind of just sells itself. So there was a lot of, you know, I want to be a part of this. And mm-hmm. Helinet jumped on board pretty much immediately. And so what we came to them with was, look, we don't have the money to do actual helicopter stunts. You know, what we want to do is we just want one of the interiors of your helicopters. We want to use one of the ones in the hangar, and we're going to put green screen up in front of it and then have our helicopter flying that way. And, you know, they were like, well, we don't have to move a helicopter. We don't have anybody flying. That's easy. And it was just taking doors off, really. And so it became a pretty straightforward, from a production standpoint, pretty straightforward thing to do. And then you're just supplementing it with the archive, too. That we do throughout the film.
And of course, with the doors off the helicopter, it made it a lot easier to shoot the interior with the back seat and the pilot seat.
Yeah, correct.
Now, how challenging was it to cast these roles for these recreations?
We spent a lot of time on it. Our casting agents over at Spark, Haley and Stephanie, were excellent. You know, they're some of the unsung stars of this. We spent probably 4 to 5 months finding recre actors that we thought looked at least similar enough mm-hmm. to our characters, our real life characters. Mac being the most important one. You know, Logan and Mac were pretty close in look. We felt, you know, even things down to like their teeth now, you know, you mm-hmm. cut from the recre Logan to the real Martin McNally and their teeth line up, which was sort of a happy accident after we cast him that we noticed that, you know. So there was just a lot of sort of little things where it was like, if we're going to be seeing this guy's face and then we're cutting to an actor, we don't want the audience taken out of it much, right, if at all.
Yeah. No, and I think Logan does an amazing job.
Agreed. He really does.
He really does a great job playing Mac. Now, you know, were you shooting this in order, in some kind of order? I mean, you started shooting your first day was skydiving. Did you have the script really mapped out, or with at least knowing what you were going to be telling? Because this is chronological. So I'm curious how the editing process was. If you had things relatively in order in terms of footage, did you have anything put together before you got your final footages of the recrees? I'm curious about that process for you.
Josh, that's on the editing front?
Yeah.
On the editing front, I mean, the process was I mean, the first biggest challenge with editing was taking the 10 hours of content and getting it down, or 6 hours of content from our podcast and getting it down to our, 97 minutes that the film ends up being. But then after that, we really just took it one chapter at a time. So we broke up the film into these 10-minute sections. And we did. We went chronologically, with the exception of the cold open. We ran through the film chronologically, and as each challenge came up, whether that was for archive or whether that was for something that we needed in the recre or pickup shot that we needed, we just took that on as it came to us.
Mm-hmm. So were you editing as you went, or did you wait until you had all the recre footage done? And then
we waited until we had all the recre footage done, but we did have a skeleton version of the film cut, where it was just what we called a radio edit, which was just the story as told by our interviews. Sure. We had that pretty much figured out, because we had to before we could figure out what recrees we needed to shoot. And so not only did we have that part of it, the general structure of the story figured out, but we also had those clips with us on set, so we could show our recre actors, hey, look, this is how Mac tells this particular version of the story. And that would inform how Logan would feel in the scene. And it would also help us to, figure out where to put the camera.
Yeah. At what point did your score come into play? I really like the music that you have, your musical compliment.
Yeah. Joshua Klieb is a fantastic composer. And we started, as most films do, with temp music, just to kind of get a feel for tone and vibe. But, even with that, we turned it over to Joshua and we said, feel free to experiment, feel free to do what you do. And he really went for it. And sometimes the vibe would stay consistent with what we had in the temp music. And sometimes he would try something completely different and it worked better. Like with all of our creative partners in this, we put a lot of trust in him. We had worked with him before on a podcast and he did a fantastic job. And this film is not this film without our score.
Yeah, I really like the score. It really complements everything very well. And it captures Mac's tone as he's talking, when he's very prideful about his planning and this, that, or the other. And the music kind of picks up on that in places that I really like. And it embraces the flaws of within human nature, within Mac.
Yeah.
Within Trapnel. I don't think anything can really fully capture Trapnel. I love the archival footage of him that you have. It actually made me laugh. I can understand why at some point in his life he was diagnosed as psycho.
And
probably should have stayed in the mental institutions. But this is one of the great things that you guys have done here, is you lay things bare. You're not trying to sugarcoat anything. We see the flaws, we hear the flaws of Mac's ideas and his plans. And, okay, the one doesn't work, but I'm going to get out of prison. And you already know, if you screwed this up and you lost $500,000 into the woods somewhere, or in a soybean field, what makes you think that you're going to figure out how to get out of prison? And what makes you think again after that fails that you're going to get out of prison? And we hear the determination in his voice and the insistence. Yes, I decided I'm getting out. I'm not staying another day. I'm getting out. But then there's trepidation, and we hear the trepidation. I don't know about this plan, Trapnel. I think maybe we need to rethink this. No, we can't do it today. And I love that we get to understand his rationale and reasoning for a lot of what he does. But you never sugarcoat anything here. You don't make him out as a folk hero or something larger than life like D.B. Cooper. I really appreciate that. Was there ever a moment that you thought about making him look better than he is?
I mean, I think that's testament to Mac. The honesty that he shows in the film is really who he is nowadays. And not only is, you know, not only does he have a mind like a steel trap where he can remember every single detail down to the minute sometimes of when something happened, but he was willing to tell his story and be completely open and honest with us. And without a reliable narrator, because so much of this story comes from one person, mm-hmm. we would not have been able to tell this story. And so I think that credit goes to Mac for that one, because, you know, he really helped guide the story. You know, he is the story. And so there wasn't a lot of chances for us to try and sugarcoat things because he was so honest with us.
I think, though, also, you know, off of that, there was always a goal to make this feel like a campfire tale / conversation, you know? And I think that there is some artistic license that we took in very limited circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also the final act feels more documentary-y, if you will.
Yeah.
Where we're seeing Mac at home in his element. Yeah, he's free, but he's living in a kind of shitty apartment, kind of in a nondescript area. He's hoarded a bunch of stuff, and he's kind of, in a way, haunted by his past.
Yeah.
And he purposefully is haunted by it. He's put himself in a position to be haunted by his past because he feels so bad about it, you know? And you kind of don't have to say anything. You kind of just drop in after we get this backstory where we've front-loaded the audience with this incredible backstory to this scene of a man being followed by cats down the street, visiting a cemetery, and then getting on an airplane. That's all he does. It's not really that interesting, but with the backstory, it's incredible, right?
It truly is, and I love the fact that in that third act, when we get down to the last couple few minutes, and we see him today, and we see Spot. Spot's wonderful. I love Spot the cat. You can't help but have some empathy for this man or sympathy for this man. You see the burden that he now carries, the emotional weight and burden. He finally, in late stage in life, he has come to terms with what a jerk he was and how he screwed up when he was younger. And anybody that can really show us that so that we feel that, that's somebody that definitely deserved his second chance. And maybe he does deserve a better apartment than what he's living in now with Spot. but there's so much heart in those final moments, guys. And you let it play out, and it's beautiful. It's really beautiful.
There's a moment, you know, there's a moment in there where Max says, and he responds to voice commands, Spot, show him your face. And there's something about that moment where, as a viewer, the first time I saw it, the 100th time I saw it, because I've seen this film a lot of times, every time I'm like, please, Spot, please listen to him. Please turn around and show us your face. And the fact that he does just makes you realize how much we empathize with this guy after spending an hour and a half listening to his story. You just want things to go well for him after all of this, after just a comedy of errors has happened to him.
Yeah. Well, there's no comedy of errors with this documentary, guys. You have done an amazing job at bringing this story, Mac's story, and then the subsequent rabbit hole that all wraps in together. It's fascinating. It's heartfelt. There are moments that are funny. When you jump out of a plane and you lose your bag with $500,000 in it, I can't help but laugh.
Yeah.
So you checked all the boxes. This is just, it's wonderful. It's really wonderful, guys. And I know from a directorial standpoint, this is your first feature-length doc. So you're directing. I can't wait to see what you do again and what story you bring us next, because this is your niche. These true crime and bringing it to life. You do it so well. I want more.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate
that. Thank you so much.
Guys, this has been so fantastic getting to speak with you. I know Mitch is frantically texting because he has to move you along. Either that or he just wants to get off the phone and is tired of listening to me. But, guys, I can't thank you enough. I hope we get to chat again in the future, which means you have to get back to work and make another film.
We're on. We got other things in the works.
I can't wait. Thank you so much, guys. And you have a great rest of your day.
You too, Debbie. Take care.